Hi, my name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. Through the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, it's not been necessary for me to have a drink or a self-administered mind-altering chemical that affected me from the neck up since April 24th, 1974. And for that, I'm really grateful. It's 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. What the hell are we doing here? What's going on? And you all smell good. It's just great. This is a real honor. I mean, holy cow, Founders Day, you know. For an Irish Catholic kid, that's like being asked to be an altar boy in Bethlehem, you know. Wow. Well, I'm a recovering Catholic. I was an altar boy, so I guess that makes me an incense survivor. I'm from Vancouver, Canada. Nobody knows where that is. It's 250 miles north of Seattle. I'm a Canadian. We're from Canada. We're the people who invented basketball and apple pie and the telephone, hockey. We gave the world Shania Twain. We'd like to apologize for Celine Dion. We're pretty much like you guys. We consider ourselves kind of unarmed Americans with health care. And we drink. Oh man, do we drink. And that's why I'm here, you know. I drink. Any chance I got, I love drinking. I love getting bombed, blasted, ripped, wrecked, ruined, everything. I mean, I just love it. I'm a 3 o'clock in the morning, stark naked, howling at the moon drunk, you know. I loved it. I first got drunk when I was 14 years old. I added some outside issues when I was 17. And by the time I was 18 years old, I'd said the phrase that only an alcoholic says. If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're listening to a drunk. If you've ever said it, welcome home. And the phrase is, I can control my drinking. Social drinkers never say that, you know? Social drinkers, if they make a fool of themselves drinking, they stop drinking. Which I think is very bizarre. But I was 18 years old, so I started on the great obsession of every abnormal drinker to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but I never got control and enjoy in the same room at the same time ever. When I was controlling my drinking, I was miserable. The only way I've ever liked to drink is wildly out of control. You know, just wahoo! That's how I drank, man. I love the effect. I didn't care what it tastes like. I mean, I liked any kind of drinks. I liked them straight up. I liked them in broken bottles. I liked them in coconut shells with stupid umbrellas. I liked it any way you got it, man. Just as long as it got there, you know. Cause I love that warm glow that went straight down your throat and that little explosion at the bottom, you know. When I was 14 years old, I suddenly realized why my father liked to go to jail so much. I mean, you know. Super. About a year ago, my home group is the participation group in Vancouver, British Columbia. We meet every Wednesday night at 8:30. It's off 49th Street, just a block west of Cambie, and it's one of the two best meetings in the world. I understand you may know of the other one. Well, we had a discussion about social drinking. Nobody knew anything about it, but we were talking about it. It was one of those theoretical meetings. You know, you get into those things, you know. So we were talking about what social drinking was, and we decided it meant that you had a drink and you didn't run naked down Main Street. You didn't go to jail. You didn't write bad checks. You didn't get tattooed. You didn't end up married to somebody you didn't know. And in our country, it could be somebody of the same sex, you know. What are you laughing at? You ever had a blackout? So anyway, I started getting bombed any chance I could. By the time I was 18 years old, I was pretty much a daily drinker. By the time I was 21, I decided I had a talent that the world couldn't live without, so I went to New York to become an actor, and by the couple of months later, I was appearing on Broadway, and I did a whole bunch of Broadway shows, and by the time I was 24 years old, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit, and I... And a couple other outside issues. I mean, it was the 60s and what the hell. So that's when I started trying to get well. You know, I started going to moral superiors for help. I went to doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists and priests and nuns and monsignors and lawyers and judges and policemen. And I would explain to them my problem, and they would point at me and say, this is what you should do. And some of them are really earnest, learned people who are really trying to help me. But somebody points a finger at me and says, this is what you should do. I bite it off at the knuckle. I have a learning disorder. You know? I can't hear it. But I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. We were going to do a show together, and she was a little dancer. She was the cutest thing I ever saw in my life. A little blonde with dimples. And the cutest tookus you ever saw. She still does. She was a little pre-Al-Anon. She didn't notice me until 3 days later when I crawled into rehearsal because my back was out and zing went the strings of her heart. I didn't know that for a pre-Al-Anon, a drunk crawling across a hotel lobby was like coming home. She realized at a very deep level that I needed her. And that I was be perfect with a little work. So I became her hobby, and eventually we started our dance of death, and we ended up tangoing into the rooms of AA and Al-Anon 30 years ago. Now I'm married to an Al-Anon. An Al-Anon is not somebody who's merely married to an alcoholic. An Al-Anon is somebody who goes to Al-Anon meetings, who works the steps of Al-Anon, the traditions of Al-Anon, sponsors all the Al-Anons, and is active in Al-Anon service. And my life has been graced by a member of Al-Anon for 30 years. I love Al-Anon. I'm sober because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm married because of Al-Anon, I'll tell you. They're the funniest bunch. You ever been around them a lot? They're just a hoot. There's some over there. Watch it. There's this moment when you meet an Al-Anon when they recognize potential. It's terrifying, you know? Anyway, we have those little Al-Anon parties at our house every once in a while. You know, 15 Al-Anons come over and they all bring too much food and they split a bottle of wine. And then at the end of the party, they argue about who's going to take what's left home. My sponsor and I got a sponsor, by the way. If you're new, get a sponsor, because this thing doesn't make any sense at all. Just get a sponsor. I mean, you need somebody to translate it because it's so weird. And my sponsor, his wife is in Al-Anon too, so we go out to dinner occasionally. We offer Chinese food. So we'll be having dinner, and Ruby will say to Bonnie, my wife, you want to split a beer? And then they talk about it. Oh, I don't know. I had one 3 weeks ago. I don't know. Oh, come on. We're out to dinner. It'll be fun. Well, I don't know. Well, all right. It might be a little fun. Okay. So they talk about it. And then they get their beers and they split it. And then it's never cold enough for Ruby. So she puts an ice cube in hers. My sponsor and I just, oh, man. I mean, come on. And then they have two sips and leave the rest. Oh. Then we'll be driving home. We'll be driving home. You better drive, honey. I've had a half a beer. So we're driving home. She's sitting here and she says, I'm loaded. Then she falls asleep. I've lived with that woman for 35 years and she still has to tell me because I can't tell. She's exactly the same loaded as she is sober. I don't even know why she bothers. You know, oddly enough, I have never had to make that announcement. You know? Somehow when I drank, everybody knew. Yeah. So anyway, we got together and on April 23rd, and it just got crazy. It got worse and, you know, just, you know, my world shrank and I was terrible. You know, the terrible thing about alcohol for me was that every time I drank, there was a moment. There was a moment of perfection, of absolute, I mean, I was everything I needed to be. And I don't know what I never could figure out the combination, you know, what alcohol and chemical, what it took to get there. But there was always, every time I drank, I mean, I was just dazzling. You know, sexy but sensitive, you know. Cool but fun, you know. Fast with my fists and a great dancer. Intellectual with a kind of self-deprecating charm. Man, I was just fabulous, you know. And then it would kind of start to tilt a little, you know. So I'd have another one just to prop it up, you know. And then it'd be 2 hours later and I'd be coming to with a circle of people looking down at me going, you know. See, I was a blackout drinker, so most of my life is a rumor. So it all came crashing down on me. You know, and the problem was that I was paying a higher and higher price for the moment. You know, I was drinking more and what had happened is my entire life had kind of shifted around so that drinking was the central issue. It was now about getting it and recovering from it and making enough money to keep the rest of it looking like that wasn't the problem and moving only with people who drank because people who didn't noticed, you know. And, you know, it just, the life just kind of wrenches around on itself. And as the disease progressed as it did with me, it got smaller and smaller and smaller because the people who didn't know that I drank too much thought that I was crazy. And so they started drifting out. I had become socially inconvenient. I was clinging to jobs because I could get it together. You know, I made up two hard and fast rules that I followed into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the two of them were, I never drank before 5 o'clock in the afternoon, except on Sundays and holidays. And I always drank from a glass, because my father was a drunk, you know, and he always drank from wine bottles wrapped in brown paper bags, and I knew if you drank like that, you were drunk. So I poured my rot gut into glasses, you know. I'm Irish Catholic, I mean, the element I lived in was alcoholism. It's like, you know, asking a fish to describe water. It's simply what we lived in. You know, everybody drank. Some of them had the failing, but we drank. Yeah. The terrible secret in our family was that we weren't actually Irish Catholic. We were actually Scottish, which is worse. It's just Irish drink, but the Scottish just are grim when they drink. You know. And the way it had happened is in the very old days of Ireland, when England decided that the north of Ireland should become Protestant, they imported all these Scottish guys to come in and conquer the Irish. And, well, you know, have you seen Irish women? Well, so did they. And the only way you can get laid is if you marry them, and the only way you can marry them is to become a Catholic. So that's why we became Irish Catholic. It had nothing to do with philosophy, it had to do with lust, is basically what I... So anyway, I was drinking more and more and more, and it was getting more and more terrifying, and my life was shrinking, and it was starting to get bizarre, and all the things that happened to us. You know, I would get up in the morning and look in the mirror, and all I saw was a waste of skin. And I would get it together, you know, to get through another day. I was so annoyed when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that you guys were drinking in the morning. I'm one of those ones that died all day, you know. If I'd have had a belt in the morning, I'd have been okay. Of course, I'd have probably gotten here 5 years earlier, too. But I just sweated it until 5 o'clock, and then I would get home. Gee, honey, I've had a good day. Pour me a drink. Gee, honey, I've had a bad day. Pour me a drink. Gee, honey, nothing much happened today. Pour me a drink. And by 6 o'clock, I was loaded. By 8 o'clock, I slipped into a blackout, and I passed out at 11, and I'd get up the next morning and do it all over again, and I thought I was living. On April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested by the West Hollywood Police Department on a sleazy little charge. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance with the front of my pants from the waistband to the knees soaked in my own urine. And it got my attention. Bonnie was off saving somebody who didn't need to be saved, so she wasn't home, so we couldn't work it out that it was all their fault. And so for the first time in my life, I was forced to look at my behavior and my drinking, and for the first time in my life, I put the two of them together. I saw the connection, and until that moment, I was not an alcoholic. Once I had seen that connection, I was an alcoholic. It's a self-diagnosed disease. It doesn't matter how many people suggested to me that I drank too much, how many people had whispered the word alcoholism, and until I put it together, I wasn't a drunk. It's that simple, and that's what's so terrifying and so sad and so pathetic about this disease. That's why so many people die of it. That's why we are so rare, being here and being sober. There are hundreds of thousands of people dying of it right now. Why we're the lucky ones, I do not know, but I sure am grateful. On April 24th, 1974, I dragged my butt into work, and there was a woman at work who had 6 years of sobriety and was having a hell of a good time. She made no bones about the fact that she was in the program, that she was sober, and things were good. She could handle stuff that were just a little beyond me. She had a great sense of humor. Her life was just sweet. And I took her aside at 11 o'clock in the morning on April 24th, and I said the last phrase. I said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces." She heard the screaming, and she dropped everything. She canceled her appointments. I was selling real estate at the time. And she 12-stepped me. We went and sat in her apartment at her dining room table, and she did the thing, you know. I want you to know that I'm deeply honored to be doing this right now, this morning, but I also want you to understand that I know what this is. This is the least important 12-step work there is. It's real easy for me to stand here and tell you my story and then jump on a plane and go to Vancouver. And you never see me again, you never see me in my office, you never see me in my living room or bedroom or in traffic, you know. But this is the least important 12-step work. The most important 12-step work is what I hope we all get the opportunities to do often, and that's one drunk talking to another. And that's what... And that's what Suzanne did for me that day. She told me her story. Now, my story was sleazy, but hers was disgusting. She had the big book on her dining room table. She read chapter 3, chapter 5, the 12 traditions. I thought, oh my God, that woman's going to read that entire book to me. And she kept jumping up and running out of the room, and I thought, oh poor darling, she must have liver damage, at least kidney. That's why she's leaving all the time. She wouldn't let me go that day. She stuck with me. She fed me. She gave me coffee and candy and everything else. And she dragged me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it was exactly like I was afraid it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It had low ceiling, gray walls. It was filled with smoke. And there were 400 people there, none of which I would have drank with. Now, I want you to know that I looked good at my first meeting. I was 6'2", weighed 155 pounds. I had a couple of commercials running on national television as the nice young man next door. I was in a navy blue blazer with a very nice tie. I had on French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and I looked fabulous. I walked into my first meeting and everybody knew that I was a drunk. It was a rather warm night in April, and to cover the smell of the booze, I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne. I had been drinking straight vodka the night before, and I smelled like a gimlet. It was kind of, the sweat was sitting on the surface of my skin, you know, that wonderful coming off a long drunk. And the other thing that gave me away was that I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only other place you see eyes like that other than a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous are on a dog loose on a freeway. I was terrified. I didn't know what you were going to do. You were the weirdest bunch I'd ever seen. And it must have been a real, it was like being dropped into a shark tank. I've never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. Oh, man. And then you started saying all this stuff. It was like being stoned to death with fridge magnets, you know. Easy does it. Keep coming back one day at a time. Think, think, think. I thought, who are these people? This is it. One day at a time, the rest of my life. Think, think, think. Keep coming back one day at a time. Oh, man. I sat down for my first meeting, and I sat next to this guy, and he started talking, and he was telling me his story, and his story was exactly the same as mine. It was an AA miracle. 400 people in a room, one guy exactly the same as me, a miracle. Suzanne did not have kidney damage. She was not going to the John. She was going to her bedroom, where she was phoning this guy. The reason his story was exactly the same as mine is he knew mine. It was a setup. And the old timers get away with it by saying more will be revealed, you know. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor. Now, if you're new, how many of you are in your first year of sobriety? Stick up your hand. Hey! All right. How do you like it so far? Right? One of the reasons I've stayed sober for 30 years, and there's a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons I never want to get sober again as long as I live. I mean, I gotta say. If you're in your first year, you only got to do it once, man, and it's the pits, let me tell you. If you're having a good time in your first year, you're not doing it right. Oh, God. So anyway, this little guy started shoving the 12 steps down my throat. Now, I was detoxing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I didn't do one of those 28-day vacations. I came to my first meeting. They gave me half a cup of coffee, a whole bunch of candy, and said, work it out, kid. So I was like, you know, I was a little jumpy when I first got here. And it was before the medical profession and the insurance companies figured out we were a big business. I mean, you know, before that, but, you know, we were kind of, I liked it because AA was still kind of sleazy in 1974. You know, it was kind of embarrassing to be in AA. It wasn't the disease of the week, and so I we all just kind of were a little, yeah. And people had grand mal seizures in AA meetings. You know, it was the guy would be up there talking, and somebody down there would go, you know, and somebody would stick a wallet in his mouth and call 911, and the meeting would go on, you know. And your sponsor, it was great because your sponsor would punch you, you know, he'd get you in the ribs and say, you keep drinking, that'll happen to you, yeah. So I want to thank everybody who had a grand mal seizure in AA meeting. You kept me sober one more day, I'll tell you that. I always wore a sports jacket to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I don't know why. And when I was about 5 days sober, they asked me to read chapter 5. So I read chapter 5, and the leader said it was the first time they'd ever heard it read in one breath. So because I had a sports jacket on, they made me stand at the door and shake hands. Now, I'd have rather stuck an ice pick in my eye than stand at the door and shake hands, but I was scared of my sponsor, so I did it. So hi, I'm Sean, you know, and I sweated a lot in my first little while. So I'd say, hi, I'm Sean, and people walk away going, oh my God. And see, I didn't know what that was. See, they do stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous to teach you how to be a loving human being, but they never tell you that, because if they told you that, you'd gag. So what they do is they get you into service. You know, you wash cups and greet at the door. And I didn't know what greeting at the door was until I'd been asked to speak at meetings occasionally in California where I got sober. And I had this little orange Honda Prelude that everybody knew. It looked like a jelly bean. And I would drive in. You know, I was going to be like the big speaker at this meeting. And I'd drive in, and I got to tell you something. I'm painfully shy. What I've done to overcompensate for it is appalling, but that's basically what it is. I hate walking into rooms full of people I don't know. I hated walking into this one. I used to have about 4 scotches to do it, you know. I mean, I it's just a wall of people. I freeze, you know. And so anyway, I'd drive into a meeting and I'd sit in my car for a while. And if anybody knew me, they'd sit there and say, look, there's Sean getting a spiritual message together. Isn't that wonderful? And what I was doing is I was sitting in the car saying, you got to get out of this car, Sean. They've seen you. You can't drive away. You know, yeah. So I would get out of the car and I crossed the parking lot and I walk up to the hall and I could hear the people talking. And there'd be some poor slob at the door whose sponsor was making him do it, you know, and he'd stick out his hand and say, I'm Fred. Welcome to the meeting, you know. And he takes my hand and he pulls me through the door. Now, he doesn't know he's doing that. And he doesn't know that that's an act of love, but that's what it is. It's one of those things that pulls guys like me through the doors. Because given my own stuff, I'd stay in the parking lot. I'd wait until the meeting was in, and then I'd drive home. You know? And so I started doing stuff like that, and I started taking the steps. First step was pretty easy for me. I mean, my life was unmanageable. I mean, I told you I looked fabulous at my first AA meeting. I had my sports jacket on. I looked wonderful. The only thing that spoiled the picture was the fingerprint ink. I mean, you can't get that stuff off. Have you noticed? Well, yeah, of course you've noticed. Yeah. I love that kind of identification in Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a men's meeting, and we used to meet in this park in Hollywood, and there was a lot of stuff going on in that park. And one day we're kind of standing outside the break in the meeting. We're kind of looking out of the park, and there was this kid just gotten busted, and they slammed him over the back of the police car, and they jammed his hands back, and they slapped on the cuffs. And you could hear the crack of the cuffs, you know, as we were standing there. And I looked down the hall, looked down the line. There was about 15 guys going. I love the head nodders in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought they were the ones with brain damage, you know, the ones that were, you know. But the head nodders are the ones who have saved my life. You know, I say something from the podium that just sounds really bizarre, I think, and then there's a bunch of guys out there go. And I go, oh, thank God I'm home, you know. But my life was clearly unmanageable. I mean, it was just shattered. It was dribbling down my sleeve. My whole thought mechanism was bizarre. And, you know, so the first step, I was powerless over alcohol. I had to concede to my innermost self that once I had one drink, I could not predict my behavior. I mean, I always admired those guys who could stop off after work and have a beer and go home, you know. I'd stop off after work and have a beer and go home in August. And, I ended up in the damnedest places with the damnedest people doing the damnedest things. I mean, it was just bizarre. So the first step was real easy for me to take. The second step came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I was getting dangerously close to that God thing, and that made me really nervous because I'd been raised in a religion. Now, I tell you, I got a learning disorder. I hear stuff that is not said, you know. I hear stuff that nobody ever said, and what I got as a picture of God was this old dude with a big beard, with a book, who was taking down everything that I not only did, but thought of doing. And I was a thinker. And for that, I was going to spend eternity in kind of a Chuck E. Cheese that was on fire. You know, having my skin flayed off with whips, but this old dude loved me. And I had a real hard time with that concept, you know, and I eventually kind of gave it up. My entire spiritual life by the time I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous consisted of the two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, "Dear God, get me out of this and I'll never do it again." And the second alcoholic prayer is, "Whew." And that was the extent of my spiritual life when I arrived here. So the second step, I thought, oh man, they're starting to do that thing on me. But what it was explained to me was the big book was a power greater than me. A room full of alcoholics was a power greater than me. My sponsor was a power greater than me. Just about anything was a power greater than me. And what I was not to do was listen to me. I was to listen to anyone else but me, because my best thinking had gotten me here smelling like a gimlet. And that I would get restored to sanity. I decided to look up. I was assigned a new best friend when I got sober. His name was Rich. And Rich had 6 months and couldn't talk. And I had a car and couldn't shut up. So we were new best friends. And we were going to this meeting on Friday nights in Beverly Hills in California. And it was a real spiffy meeting. And so you got dressed up, you know, because it was really... Every caterer in Beverly Hills who got sober got to be the refreshment person. I remember one time going to this meeting and there was an ice sculpture in the middle of the refreshment. You know. So it was very spiffy. And it was the 70s and we all had big hair in the 70s, you know. And Rich, unfortunately, his was thinning, so he had to do a lot of work on his. So I went over to pick him up one night while he kind of tortured his hair forward and then he kind of sprayed it and bent it and folded it back and... So it got, you know, so we all looked like Peter Lawford, you know, with our hair helmets. And it was taking a while, so he had a big medical dictionary, and I looked up a definition of insanity, and it was a big, long one, but there was a phrase in the middle of it that enabled me to take the second step. And the phrase was, this is a medical definition, quote, "a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes." Let me run that by you one more time. A seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Took the second step right there, right then. That was me. I was constantly slamming into the same brick wall. I never took the time to examine why I was slamming into the same brick wall. All I wanted to do was get out of that situation. My philosophy of life was, a moving target is harder to hit. And that's how it went for me. So... Then came the third step, was that I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand God. Oh my God, there we are. My sponsor told me that I had to pray. I said, why? He said, none of your business, you got to do it. And I said, okay. And he said I had to do it in the morning and in the evening, and so I started doing it, and it was acutely embarrassing. I would go into the bathroom and lock the bathroom door, get down on my knees in the morning, and say, okay, God, keep me sober today and let me know what you want me to do. And then I would get up and look around, and then act cool as I came out of the bathroom. And then at night I would go in and lock the bathroom door, get down on my knees, and say, thank you, God, for keeping me sober. And I'd get up and look around. Act cool. I left the door open when I puked, but I locked it when I prayed. But I misunderstood what the third step was. I thought when you got to the third step, you had to have a God thing. You had it all worked out, you know? And that's not what it was about. What it is a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God, no matter how limited that understanding. And it's a decision. That's what it is. If I decide I want a new house, I don't have the keys. If I decide I want a new house, I buy a newspaper and I look up ads for real estate. And then I find a realtor and I go work with that realtor. We go look around at a whole bunch of houses and eventually we find one we like and we make an offer and they make a counter offer and we make another offer and we do it. We agree on a price and then I go to the bank and then I get the escrow stuff done and insurance and all that kind of stuff and the moving van and everything else. And months after making the decision, after taking all these steps, I get the key to the house. And that's what the third step is about, is I make a decision to take a whole bunch of steps to get the key to the house. So there I was, poised on this adventure, and I got to tell you something, man, about sobriety. If this was just a journey, I wouldn't have bothered with it. I'd been on a hell of a lot of journeys, but it was assured that this was an adventure. Now, I'm always up for an adventure. So I started out on this adventure, and when you start out on an adventure, you got to know what you're packing. You got to know what you're taking with you, what the baggage is, what the luggage is, and that's what the fourth step is. The fourth step is I took an inventory of what I was carrying. That's all it was. I was 3 weeks sober when my sponsor, who had been so cute up to then, turned on me and said, you got 3 weeks to do your fourth step, and here's the date we're doing your fifth step. Now, I was 3 weeks sober. I didn't know you couldn't do a fearless and thorough moral inventory, so I did it. Simple. Laid out who I was based on what the big book talks about, fears, resentments, sexual problems, and there we are. So I examined the luggage. I brought it to my sponsor and said, here's who I am. This is not who I'm like. I mean, this is somebody I'd known six weeks. I mean, I'm not going to tell all my secrets to somebody I've known 6 weeks. I'll tell you a couple, and you tell me a couple of yours, and then if you crowd me, I'll threaten to expose you. I mean, that's how we work it. But here I was, talking to this guy, telling him everything that I could think of about myself. The exact nature of my wrongs. And he shared his. And all of a sudden, the phone calls got shorter. Because I no longer had to explain the problem to this guy. He had all the information. The phone calls went from a half an hour to 5 minutes. It was amazing. And then he also started doing things like saying, listen, that guy over there, he's got some things going on. You need to go talk to him and share from your experience. I said, did you tell him? I mean, knock it off. Go over and talk to him. Yeah. So I go over and share the things that I was going to my grave with some guy who was dying in a corner. And I started finding out what the power of one alcoholic talking to another was about. It's not about the good news that we share that makes everybody great. You know, it's the bad news we share that makes it possible for us to get through another day some days. So we looked at who I was and became entirely ready to have God remove it. I had to drop some of the luggage. I mean, there was stuff that I had to let go of. Stuff that had become my coping mechanisms, you know. Some of them were to hide and cover character defects that were killing me. And then I had to work on some stuff that I didn't have. Because you know what? I was 31 years old. I was sophisticated. I was jaded. I'd been way too many places and seen too much and done too much and was pretty cynical about what the world was and what it was about. And I was street smart and could make my way anywhere, but I didn't have a lick of common sense. Not any. I had no idea about basics of life because I had overridden them all my life. And so what we started doing, we started shedding being hip, slick, and cool. And I got to be stupid for the first time in my life. Thank God. If I hadn't gotten to be stupid, I'd have never gotten here. So he told me in order to embark on this adventure, I had to clean up the campground, and that meant I had to make a list of all the people I had harmed. Not all the people I had annoyed, but the people that I had harmed. Because there were legions of people that I had annoyed, very few of which I had harmed. So I did a list, and he went through them with me. He now had all the information from the inventory. And I started on making those amends. I'd like you to think that I've got some kind of high moral value here, you know, that I have really kind of evolved into a kind of spiritual human being. But basically, there's a lot of stuff I do that I do because I don't want to have to make amends anymore. I mean, I hate making amends. They embarrass me. I mean, they're just real. And I mean, I never, I never did anything really. I mean, I didn't come to AA like off of death row like a regular guy in AA. You know, I never did anything that was really very interesting. I mean, I just did a bunch of sleazy, tacky, embarrassing, shabby, smarmy, slimy little thing. I mean, stuff I don't want to talk about. I still don't want to talk about it. And I certainly didn't want to come to you and bring it up again and talk about it. But I had to. Because he told me if I didn't, I'd drink again. And I believed him. I still believe him. And so I went. You know, Megan, I'm sorry I threw up on your Christmas tree. But I got this disease. You know, those ones at the beginning are really easy. Those ones aren't bad. When you're 5 years sober and you're still acting like a jerk and you got to go do them, those are the ones I hate. So I did them, and you know what? When I was halfway through them, all those promises started coming through. It was absolutely amazing. So then I got hooked on them. I started making amends to everybody I could find. Man, I was making calls and, you know, putting $5 in envelopes every month and doing it all. Man, I love doing it. I love that. I love, for the first time in my life, feeling clean. I love, for the first time in my life, feeling not better than or less than, but just eyeball to eyeball. I love that, you know? Oh, boy. And then comes that 10th step. That 10th step is where, you know, continue to take personal inventory. And I do that on a daily basis. I told you I was raised an Irish Catholic. So what I do, what did I do today that was right? And what did I do the day that I was wrong? All the wrong stuff. I used to beat myself up more than anybody would ever do it. You know, so I was having a hard time with that kind of stuff because I do a lot of wrong stuff. And so what I do, what I started doing and I do to this day is I look at my day and say, what did I do today that I approve of? And what did I do today that I don't approve of? And the stuff that I approve of, I say, gee, that's swell, thanks, let's put that aside. And the stuff that I don't approve of, I set out to work on and you know, kind of get a plan as to how not to be such a jerk. And I when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Aha, promptly admit it. I got to tell you, if you want to stay married, work the 10th step. You know, there's no trick to saying, honey, you remember that fight we had 4 months ago? I was wrong. But to stop in the middle of it and say, whoa, wait a minute, I am way off base here, and I got no stake in who wins this argument. You know, you can have it. You win. Bonnie's got some great phrases from Al-Anon that have seeped into my vocabulary, like, you could be right. You could be right, man. I love that. I mean, you're not actually saying they are. You're just kind of conceding. She's great. I live in Vancouver. We got lots of boats in Vancouver. We got a lot of ocean, and it's just great, and I love it. And so I got obsessed with buying an old wooden boat. I mean, how stupid is that? So every marina you go to, there's always one that's kind of sinking down at the end of the pier. And, you know, you arrive at lunch hour because that's when I go looking. So I'd have my suit on and the boat salesman would go, wow, you know, here's another sucker. Come on, let's go. You know, take me down there and say, well, it just needs a little work. You know, well, it seems to be a little low in the bow. Yeah. And so I looking was the operative word, but occasionally I would fall in love. And I would come home and I'd say, Bonnie, I found an old Chris Craft and it just needs a little work and it's just a little work. And it's got this beautiful wood. It'll really be beautiful once we strip it down and varnish it 100 times. And of course, I got some patchwork to do on it to keep it floating. And the engine, well, it needs to be totally redone. But it's going to be beautiful. And I don't think I can live without it. And Bonnie's been in Al-Anon long enough, she doesn't go, you idiot! What she says is, I know you'll do the right thing. Is that the pits? Guess what? I don't have a boat. Now, the 11th step is we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, as we understand. Now, hey, I'm a child of the 60s. I know about meditation. A little smoke, a little sitar music. Hey, yeah. So I started meditating. I mean, I got into meditation. I mean, we are enthusiasts if we're not anything. I mean, you get me into anything, I get into it, you know. So I started buying spiritual literature. I read every self-help. I was at one point in my sobriety, I was in imminent danger of being killed by a falling bookshelf of spiritual literature. Yeah. So over the years, we kind of simplified it, and this is basically what I do as a meditation on a daily basis. If any of you guys are having trouble with meditation, this is what I do. I sit in a comfortable chair. I don't lie down because that's called napping. I tend to drift off when I meditate. So I sit in a comfortable chair and I concentrate on the phrase, "Be still and know that I am God." It's something out of the other big book. And I break it down word for word. As I'm sitting there, I close my eyes and I just be. And I hear the traffic and I hear the radio somewhere and somebody laughing and my stomach gurgling, I just be. And then I be still. I just stop moving. Just stop moving. I be still. Listen to my breath going in and out and just be still. And be still and know. And what I do is I imagine the top of my head opening up and just knowing that I'm part of the universe and the earth and everything. I just know that. Be still and know that. And then be still and know that I am. And what that is that's that little voice inside me. That's inside all of us. That we just didn't listen to. That we ignored, that we told to shut up and go away as we were getting loaded and living outside our own moral fence line. While we were doing stuff that we didn't approve of for ourselves, we ignored that voice. And we got frightened of that voice. And then when we first got here, we couldn't trust it. By the time you get to the 11th step, you can start to listen to it. You start hearing it. Be still and know that I am. And then I let it identify itself. Be still and know that I am God. Because that's what it is. It's what the nuns said was the soul, what any of the organized religions have for it, the third eye, whatever you want to call it. It's the thing that connects me to you. It's the intuitive thing about us as alcoholics. It's how intuitively we know each other. It's that thing. I love that in Eastern religions where they meet each other and the greeting is the God in me greets the God in you. And that's what it is. And that's what connects us and ultimately connects this room to something way beyond us. And that's what's enabled me to step into a spiritual life. I've never returned to a religious life, but I've certainly embraced and lived and continue to try and live a spiritual life. You know, and we've been told in that other big book that we are created in the image and likeness of God, and I don't think it's how we look. I think it's how we act. I think that's when we look like God. And I can see it in AA meetings. I see it clearer in AA meetings for me because it's just where I see it mostly. And because I see it in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I can see it in my whole world. But I can see it when some little old lady says to some 15-year-old punk chick who's tattooed from head to toe, "Come sit next to me, dear." I can see the family resemblance. I can see it with the guy who goes cross town to central office and buys a box full of literature and gets back on the bus and brings it back to me. I can see how we resemble God. I can see it by the one who gets there at 6 o'clock and puts on the coffee so that it's ready at 8 o'clock. I can see it in the woman who's standing at the door shaking hands. I can see it when a guy holds another guy as he cries his eyes out. I can see how we look like God when we're acting sober and when we're carrying the message and we're being service of God. And because you've done that over the years and I've got to observe you doing it, it's made it easy for me to step closer to a God of my understanding. And I want to thank you for it because it's been a great comfort to me. And I ask only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, I got 30 years of sobriety, and I'd like to think that I had some wisdom. But all I got is experience. I thought I'd be much further along by now. I thought I would have evolved into something kind of wonderful. But I'm absolutely amazed at my capacity to become a jerk at any moment. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Oh, God. A couple of years ago, I got it right in the nose about who I was. You know, where I live in Vancouver, we have four lanes of traffic that merge into two lanes to go over a bridge to get to my home. So four lanes of traffic merge. I mean, we're Canadians. We do that well. We line up great. I mean, people from Los Angeles come to take pictures of it. They can't believe it. Yeah. So, you know, and you merge, and everybody knows you merge. You let somebody in front of you. You know, it's just great. Now, this is how spiritually evolved I am. I have this real thing about small blonde women in huge black SUVs. They just make me nuts. Because once they get into these huge black SUVs, they turn into monsters. You know, they're just... So I'm merging, and I got my little Honda, which is down here, you know. And I'm merging, and there's this, you know, SUV with this little blonde, you know, with her hair weighed more than she did, and she had a cell phone and a latte. I don't know how the hell she was driving the thing. It must have been with her skinny little knees. And it's my turn to merge. Mine. And we're driving along. And she's not backing off so I can merge. Now, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I drank away my rights, but, you know, work with me here. So we're driving along and she's talking with her 4-inch French fingernails. And we're driving along and it's getting crucial. I mean, we're getting into the lane. So I roll down my window. And just to communicate to her in all the love and tolerance, I went way up with that sign there so she could see it. Captain Sobriety here. Yeah? So she noticed it, went, you know, and let me in. And I said, oh, thank God I took off the honk if you're a friend of Bill W. sign off my back. Didn't want her to know what I was doing. I had some problems with skin cancer since I was about 4. I mean, I've had good news and bad news in this. You know, if you stick around long enough, life happens. Miracles happen and stuff happens, you know. So I've been having a little trouble with, I'm one of those blonde, blue-eyed kids I was, that got fried every summer, and so I started paying for it, and they started taking little bits of me away, and they do that. Every 6 months, I go to see my dermatologist, and they go, oh, well, let's take that, you know. So my body now looks like a railroad map of New Jersey, and So I got something on my ear, so they decided, they sent me to the cancer clinic, and these six doctors come in, and they look at the ear, and they go, ooh, and out they go. And then one comes back and says, okay, here's what's going on. I said, what happened to the other five? Well, I'm the consulting physician. I said, okay. So I said, there's a couple of things we can do. One of the things that we can do is to remove the ear and most of the tissue around it. And I said, and God, you're just a bundle of good news, doc. What else you got? Yeah. They said, no, we can make a prosthesis, you know, that we do wonderful stuff with prosthesis that will attach to your skull with magnets. I said, this is getting better and better, doc. And then, you know, I forget I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous so long, you know, we laugh at the bad stuff and cry at the good stuff and call it Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So that alcoholic sense of humor clicks in, you know. So I start rapping on it. You know, wait a minute. Ears. I mean, I could like get a Spock ear, couldn't I? Like, you know, I could have a whole assortment. I could get one with jewelry, so I wouldn't actually have to have my ears pierced. You know, just I could get. Oh man. And then you know, I'll just take it off and pin it to the refrigerator. Yeah. with a note that says, don't forget to get the milk and the margarine and pick up the cleaning, you know. Or else, the best thing is, you know, when Bonnie's on one of her things, you know, I can just take it off and say, here, talk to this, I'm going to take a nap.
Well,
so I'm getting with it.
Yeah.
Hey. This guy's eyes are getting like saucers, you know. He's thinking we better ship this one to the psych ward. It's just down the hall. He said, or we can do 15, radiation treatments. And I said, well, why don't we try that first, huh? So they deep fried my ear, and here I am. I didn't, you know. And then they also took off my nose and took some stuff off and put it back on. That was fun. And so I'm going through that kind of stuff, you know. And in the meantime, I'm doing some of the most creative work I've ever done. I've written and produced a movie. I'm doing just incredible stuff, just wild stuff. And then I open a newspaper, and that's going great. And then it crashes and burns, and we lose all our money. And 6 years ago, we end up living in a little condo. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is the end of my life. And you know, and just good times and bad times. And then about a year ago, I got this terrific job. I run a theater in Vancouver in the middle of Stanley Park. It's just the best job, and things are going great. And the end of last season, I woke up one morning gurgling. It was like I was drowning. And my wife said, why don't you go to the doctor? I said, it's nothing, you know. And so a couple of days later, I crawled into an emergency ward, and I had coronary congestive heart failure. And so they looked at me, and my heart was greatly enlarged, and the normal heart pumps about 60%. I was pumping 25%, and so I wasn't doing really well. And so they said, they put me on some meds and did some stuff, and they said if I'd had this condition 10 years ago, they'd have sent me to bed and that would have been it, but they've made some remarkable stuff. And so they started giving me the stuff, and I started doing what I was told. You know, but I'm an alcoholic, and if somebody in a white coat starts talking to me, I go deaf. I mean, they just start saying, you know, they start saying, like, this is critical, blah, 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 and I can't hear anything else they say. It's like wind, you know. So I come home, and Bonnie says, what did the doctor say? I go, you take a pad and a pencil. So I take a pad and a pencil, and the guy says, and this is what's happening. I go, so finally, Bonnie said, that's it, I'm going with you. That's it. So she goes with me now, and she asks all the questions. Those Al-Anons, you know, nothing more terrifying than an Al-Anon with a mission, let me tell you. Whoa. So anyway, I've been doing what I've told. And I started, I've been doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot of years. I believe in that. I've done it from the day I got sober. The day I got sober, I washed my cup and emptied my ashtray and folded up my chairs, and I've been doing all that. So I've been alternate delegate, and I've been, you know, chairperson of this, that, and I've done a ton of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still do. But I also started doing it in my community, and I've been doing, you know, work in my own community, and I got to tell you something. Last Wednesday, I became the president of the West Vancouver Chamber of Commerce. You can't get here from there. You can't get to the presidency of the Chamber of Commerce from the front of your pants soaked in urine and fingerprint ink. You can't get there. You can't do it. You can't do it for me without 12 steps and 12 traditions and a fellowship and people who love each other at the level we love each other. I went to see my doctor. Went to see my heart guy. I had to go see my heart guy. So they do all the things and they go, and the doctor's going, hey, Fred, get in here. George, come here. Look at this. Come here. And I say, oh, my God, this is it. You know, I got 12 seconds to go. He said, I've never seen anything like this. My heart has shrunk to normal size, and I'm pumping 55%. The doctor said, what happened? I said, well, you did what you're supposed to do. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and I know thousands of people who pray. And that's the truth. So how's my life today? Wow. I mean, I'm here with my daughter, Kate. My daughter's 22 years old and gorgeous, and you invited me and a guest, and Bonnie couldn't be here because Bonnie's so successful at her business. Bonnie was a little girl who from Cleveland, Ohio, who was a stutterer. By the time she got to Al-Anon, she was, if you looked at us as a couple, you'd think she was the one that was in trouble. She was absolutely crazy. She was angry. She was sad. She was frightened. She was turned inward to a degree that was unbelievable. The reason she can't be here is she's one of the most successful public relations people in Vancouver. She has her own business with a partner, and they're probably the most successful public relations and press relations company in the city. And that's because of Al-Anon. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has 37 years. His name is Milton. Milton's a great guy. Milton was one of the original Dominoes. And he's 80 years old, and I love him very much. He's a black guy, and his wife, Ruby, is Chinese. They were essentially Kate's grandparents. Kate one time said, you know, when they have grandparents' day, Milton, I'm taking you. And he just tears up. Well, he tears up, but I'm like him. I mean, you stick around long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you tear up at supermarket openings and card tricks. And look at that sunset. Oh, you know. I got to tell a story about Kate. Kate was born when I was 8 years sober. When I was 10 years sober, I was asked to speak on the North Shore of Oahu in Hawaii. And Kate got to travel with us because she was a day before her second birthday. So she went with us. She got a free flight. So we were over in Hawaii. And by chance, a friend of mine had a condominium that was right next door to where the conference was, and there was a beach right there. And I'm a guy that had somehow lost his capacity to love. Fear and anger and all that kind of stuff had just destroyed it and ripped it up. It was starting to come back, but I didn't realize how much it had come back until one morning at the conference. We were down at the beach, Kate and I. And Kate was 2 years old, and she was little, and she has hair that was the color of the sunset. And she was running in and out of the surf, laughing like and squealing like a little two-year-old would. And I was standing there, and I realized that I love Kate as much as I love Bonnie, that my capacity to love had doubled somehow. And I realized something about her that no matter who she was and no matter where she went or what she did, that I would always love her, not because she's perfect, but because she's mine. And because of that moment, it taught me something about my God. I believe that my God loves me like that. I believe that my God loves me not because I'm perfect, but because I'm His. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you I got a learning disorder, and I came here frightened and terrified and knowing that it wouldn't work for me. But I screwed up enough courage to tell you a little about myself, and you said the magic phrase. You said the thing that enabled me to stay here long enough to get sober enough to pass it on. You said, I know how you feel. None of those people, none of those professionals, none of those people that I went to for help had ever said that. But that was the magic phrase. That's the miracle phrase that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, of one drunk talking to another. When one drunk says, I know how you feel. As soon as you say that to me, all the anxiety, all the fear, all the anger dampens down enough for me to hear you. And then you have never said, this is what you should do. You have always said, this is what I've done. And when you tell me that, I can learn that. You see, these 12 steps, you don't have to take them. We don't ask you to. All we do is tell you that we've taken them. You have a choice of what you want. It's all suggested. Now, personally, I find the suggestions in Alcoholics Anonymous to be along this line. This plane is on fire. We suggest you jump out. Then we suggest you count to 10. And then we suggest you pull the ripcord. Of course, it's up to you. And because of your ability to teach me, you have always been my teachers. Rooms full of people like you are my teachers. And so I come to you today to report to you on my progress. I stand before my teachers to let you know who I am. And although I've got a long, long way to go, because of you and rooms like this, I have